Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches, and that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on Facebook at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now, Jim Andrews continues his study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us on The Final Word. We continue our study of the book of Esther. What we are focusing on in this book is the providential hand of God. As most of my listeners probably know, but maybe some do not, the name of God is not mentioned even once in the book of Esther. That has puzzled some who have been troubled by its so-called secularity. But that is not the case at all. This book is highlighting the hidden hand of God and deliberately does not mention God because he is clearly at work behind the scenes. And in one particular passage, I will show you that so obviously in the words of Mordecai. Mordecai knows that. From beginning to end, we see God working providentially, and let me explain what we mean by that. The providence of God, as I define it, is the hidden hand of the sovereign God working not directly, as in the case of miracles, but working through human agents and circumstantial instruments of an impersonal nature, or both. But God is clearly at work in bringing about the fulfillment of his plan and carrying out his purposes. Let us review briefly and continue with our observations based on this narrative. The book of Esther was written during that 58-year gap that occurs between the 6th and 7th chapters of Ezra. In case you want to know, the span of time covered by the book is about 10 years. The events of Esther were around the time of 483 B.C. to 473 B.C. when Xerxes, known in this book as Ahasuerus, was on the throne of the Persian Empire. Virtually everything that happens is an obvious component of the hidden hand of God, who is working out his purposes and working to counteract those purposes of Satan, who was conspiring to set up a circumstance whereby the Jewish people would be the objects of a genocide at the hands of one Haman, who turned out to be an Amalekite related to the Amalekite king Agag, against whom God had pronounced back in the times of Moses a ban, a curse. And it had been Israel's duty to extirpate the tribe of the Amalekites, and King Saul was given that specific assignment, which he failed to fully carry out. One of his relatives, a guy by the name of Mordecai, figures prominently in this book as the older cousin of Hadassah or Esther. They become the central figures in the plot of this book, which centers around Haman, the Agagites, intention to commit genocide against the Jewish people in the Persian realm. Now, let's go back and bring the story up to date and move on. Esther has replaced Vashti as the queen of Persia. That came about in a very interesting way, all in the providence of God. Her adopted father, we'll call him Mordecai, had carefully instructed Esther when she was selected to be a candidate for the queenship of the Persian Empire not to reveal her Jewish roots. And compliantly, she kept that in the background, and that becomes a very important figure in what is going to happen. Mordecai himself was a man of no mean standing, because we always find him sitting at the king's gate, which was not a place for any Tom, Dick, and Harry. We are told, and this was a significant stroke of the providence of God, because it's going to play greatly just a little later here, Mordecai one day was sitting at the king's gate, and just like people in well-placed positions in Washington, D.C., will overhear scuttlebutt. And a scuttlebutt he heard, or overheard, was an assassination plot against the king. Through his contacts, he was able to get to Esther, informed Esther to alert the king. The matter was investigated. It proved to be true. There was a palace intrigue with a couple of people well-placed who could have actually executed the plot, but thanks to Mordecai's information, it was interdicted, and it never happened, but it was written in the king's chronicles. We see at the end of chapter 2. That was forgotten immediately, but that will play big as the plot develops. And all of this is in the providence of God. Little pieces. What I pointed out are relatively insignificant things, some seemingly humdrum, but all of them play a role in the outcome of this book. Well, we read in chapter 3. Here's where we're introduced to another very important player. But after these events, that is, the plot against the king, after Esther was made the queen, Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agite. Again, that's Agag, the king of the Amalekites. So here again, we have a confrontation of a descendant of the line of Saul, Mordecai, and a descendant of the Amalekites, against whom God had placed a ban. Haman must have been a quite capable man and politically astute, for the king Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, advanced Haman and established his authority over all the princes who were with him. This is almost like Joseph and Pharaoh, except that Haman was nothing like Joseph. So all the king's servants who were at the king's gate, again, that tells us that was a place of influence, bowed down and they paid homage to Haman. This is all underscored so that we will know what a position of power this man held. And therefore, he was an immense danger to the Jewish people, for he hated him, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But one thing bothered Haman. This man Mordecai neither bowed nor paid homage to Haman as he strutted his stuff after he was elevated. The king's servants who were at the king's gate were puzzled and perhaps put off by this, and they said to Mordecai, "Why are you transgressing the king's command?" This very tension between the two is going to play big in this unfolding drama. All of this, part of God's providence, God directing things or God allowing things, but behind it all, Satan animating this wicked Haman to do what he was going to conspire to do. Well, apparently that went on. They were kind of insistent that Mordecai pay his tribute to Haman. The reason Mordecai wouldn't do so is not because he wouldn't bow before another man. People bowed before kings all the time, including the Jews. But evidently it was because he recognized who Haman was. He recognized his Amalekite roots. And there was no way that Mordecai was going to bow to an Amalekite who was under a ban, under a curse from God. Well, this just set Haman's hair on fire. When he saw that Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage to him, Haman was filled with rage. But we're told in verse 6 of chapter 3 that he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for by this time he had learned who the people of Mordecai were, namely the Jews, and all of the Hitler in him sought to destroy all the Jews, not just Mordecai. And the Jews were, of course, dispersed throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. So, in April or May of 474 B.C., in the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of the king Ahasuerus, this is about the time of Passover, ironically. We are told that Pur means Lot, was cast before Haman from day to day and from month to month until the 12th month, that is the month of Adar. This was apparently an astrological calculation, trying to pick out the best month, most propitious month to execute his vile and murderous plan. When it arrived at it, Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "And here the devil is behind all of this to destroy the Jewish people, to destroy God's elect people. When people hate God, they hate his people. And when they hate his people, they hate God. This is the enemy at work, and God's about to counteract it." Haman said to the king, "Your Majesty," I paraphrase, "there's a certain peculiar people scattered and dispersed among the peoples of all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of other people." Of course, he was implying in somewhat diplomatic language that they were rebellious and obstreperous, which they had not been. There was nothing wrong with their laws being different. There would have been something if their laws were contradicting the king's authority. "They do not observe the king's laws," implying that they were in a state of rebellion. So Haman told the king, "It's really not in your interest, Your Majesty, to let them remain. So here's what I propose." And it was a genocidal pact. "If it pleases the king, let it be decreed." And once it was decreed, I pointed out, in Persian law, it was fixed. It could not be reversed. "So let it be decreed that they be destroyed. I myself will pay 10,000 talents of silver," quite a sum of money, "into the hands of those who carry out the king's business." In other words, I will fund this to put the booty in the king's treasuries. Well, the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agite, the enemy of the Jews. And there again, it's underscored. And behind this is the hand of Satan. "And the king said to Haman, 'The silver is yours, the people also, to do with them as you please.'" Just get it done. Sounds good to me. Well, post haste, the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month. And it was written just as Haman commanded to the king's local authorities and governors, provincial governors, written in their script. Again, careful about communication, getting the message out fast. And letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces. And those letters directed them to commit a pogrom, a genocide, to destroy, to kill, to annihilate all the Jews. Hitler was not the first people, both young and old, women and children. And to do it in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, to seize their possessions as plunder. We're told that a copy of the edict was issued as law in every province, published to all the peoples, that they should be ready and armed, locked and loaded for this day, to take out the Jewish people wherever they were in the Persian kingdom. So couriers went out, impelled by the king's command, while the decree was issued in Susa, the capital. And then, with complete indifference, the king and Haman sat down to drink, while the city of Susa, many Jews there, was in confusion, you can imagine. Well, in chapter 4, when Mordecai learned all that had been done, we're told he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, the customed expression of mourning among the Jews. And he went out into the midst of the city, and there he wailed loudly and bitterly. He went as far as the king's gate, but he went no further, for no one was to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. That would be bad form, and this implies that otherwise he might have been able to go inside the king's gate, which again implies that he was a man of some standing. All of that will play in the providence of God. God has all the pieces on the table. Well, in each and every province where the command and decree of the king came, and of course there were Jews scattered all over, there was correspondingly great mourning among the Jewish people, knowing their days were numbered. There was fasting and weeping and wailing, and a great many lay in sackcloth and ashes. Why did they fast? The name of God is not mentioned, but obviously there was prayer. Fasting and prayer went together like hand and glove. Well, up to now, Esther knew nothing about what was going on outside the walls. Her maidens and her eunuchs came, and they told her. and the queen writhed in great anguish. Still nobody knew that she was a Jewess. She sent garments to clothe Mordecai that he might remove his sackcloth from him, but he wouldn't accept them. So then Esther summoned Hatak from the king's eunuchs, whom the king had appointed to attend her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai and to learn what this was and why it was. It was all a mystery to her. She needs some clarity. So Hatak went out to Mordecai to the city square in front of the king's gate. And there Mordecai informed him, gave him the intelligence that he needed to carry back to Esther, told him all that had happened to him, the exact amount of money that Haman had promised to pay to the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews, and he gave him a copy of the text of the edict, which had been issued in Susa for the Jews' destruction, so that he might get Esther fully informed. And also, he sent instructions via this attendant of Esther's to order her to go into the king to implore the king's favor and plead with Xerxes for her people, Ahasuerus. Well, Hatak came back and related Mordecai's words to Esther, told her that Mordecai had urged her to use her position and influence to prevent this genocide. Well, Esther was a gentlewoman, and she spoke to her attendant, Hatak, and ordered him to reply to Mordecai and give him this message. All the king's servants and the people of the king's province, they all know that any man or woman who barges into the king in the inner court, who happens not to be summoned by the king, there is but one law. It's fixed. There's no negotiation. There's no parsing. That person will be put to death unless the king holds out to that person the golden scepter so that he might live. Otherwise, he's done for. Now, the fact is, I have not personally been summoned to come to the king for these 30 days. Bottom line, even though I'm the queen, if I go walking in there and the king doesn't hold out the golden scepter, it doesn't matter who I am. I'm dead meat. So they related Esther's words to Mordecai. We're about to see the providence of God in big, bold letters. Mordecai told them to reply to Esther. And here it is. The name of God is not mentioned, but if anybody can't see God in this, they are unimaginably blind. Esther, I don't want you to think that there in the king's palace, even though nobody knows your ethnicity, that you can escape any more than all the Jews. In other words, if she fails to stand up for God's people, God is not going to let her escape. He did not use those words. But that's what he meant. It's clear in verse 14. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. Well, how in the world could he say that if his underlying proposition was not that God is there, that he is not silent, that he made promises to the Jewish people, and he is going to save his people from one source or another? You may or may not be a part of that as you choose, but if you don't choose, given the advantage that you have to serve God in this way, risking your own life, then you and your father's house will perish. God will see to it. He doesn't say that. That is the clear implication. God is in all of this and in Mordecai's mind. And here it is even clearer, he says in verse 14. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this? Mordecai lives in a world of purpose, and it would not be a world of purpose, could not be a world of purpose, unless God is there, and unless the hidden hand of God is active and moving in human events. And that is exactly the worldview that Mordecai has. He doesn't have to use the name of God. When I'm talking about science, I don't have to use the word science. When I'm talking about history, I don't have to use the word history to be talking about history. And when I'm talking about God, I don't have to use the name of God. As I say, the name of God is deliberately in the background because this whole book is an illustration, a powerful illustration of the sovereign hand of God working through individuals and through means. the sovereign hand of God, orchestrating circumstances and orchestrating the minds and actions of human beings to bring about a result that he intends. And I emphasize that so strongly, as I've said before, because God, my friends, does not change. This is God as he was dealing with the Jewish people and the Persian Empire in this period between 483 and 473. But this same God is active in your life, and he's in my life. And he's doing for his people what he intends to do. He's working out his purpose. He's working out his plan. And he works behind the scenes. It's not only for nations. It is for his people and is for individuals. And that should give us great encouragement. Well, Esther found the courage based upon Mordecai's words there in verse 14 of chapter 4. So, summoning her courage, she told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go, assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa, and fast for me." You don't see the word God there, but you see the word fast. And that implies prayer, and prayer implies address to God. Obviously, God is here, not mentioned, because we're dealing with the hidden hand of God. "Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day, and my maidens will also fast in the same way. And thus I will go in to the king, which is not in accordance with the law." You know, it is against the law, but I'm going to do it. "And if I perish, I perish." God's will be done, she is effectively saying. So Mordecai went away and did just as Esther commanded him. Still, nobody knew so far that Esther was a Jewess. A lot of times, my dear friends, we are put in places by the hidden hand of God, just as Esther was. We don't know why we're in those places. We don't know what intention God has. The Lord hasn't revealed that to us. But we must all consider in the providence of God that God has a reason, he has a purpose, he has a time and place for everything. There are things that I can't figure out in my life and you can't figure out in your life. But we must always consider the providence of God and the fact that the hidden hand of God is moving the pieces around as he pleases. I was teaching in seminary until I was 52 years old. I had long since given up any idea that I would ever be back in the pastorate. But at age, I said 52, but actually at age 53, it came about through a series of circumstances, and all of those I can go back and see are providential. I wound up here in the suburb of Portland, Lake Oswego, as a pastor of a church. I never planned on it. Who's looking for a 53-year-old pastor? And yet, here I've been. I would have never dreamed it. And I must tell you that in these years, I've often wondered, why did God put me in this place and at this time in my life? And why did God put me for about 21 years of my career in academic ministry? These are things I don't know the answer to, but I can go back and I can see God's hand clearly working, his hidden hand, in moving me around and moving the pieces around and causing this to happen. And I don't know the outcome. I don't know what part I'm playing in any particular drama in the overall scheme of things. But I see this same providential hand of God at work in my life, and if you'll look around at your life, I'm sure you'll see it too. And that ought to give us immense encouragement. Well, friends, we'll pick up there the next time. Thank you for joining us on The Final Word.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. And our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program is ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.